Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Our first guest is Christopher Ebert. He is the author of Angels of Detroit. It's become an American symbol, Detroit has, for urban decay. And it's one of the characters of his book. Christopher Ebert joins me in studio to talk about Angels of Detroit. Chris, nice to have you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I understand you're a former resident of St. Louis, briefly, I guess, in 1998.
It was brief, but meaningful.
As much as it had some influence on the writing of this book.
It absolutely did. And, I moved here the year after I finished college. One of my best friends at the time was in art school at Wash U. And I moved here just thinking I wanted a place where I could go and try to be a writer. That was what I was interested in doing. Huh. So I came here, and one day I was listening to the radio. I was living in Soulard. I was driving to my... I worked at the Library Limited bookstore when that was still around.
Sure.
I was making that drive one day, and I was listening to the radio, and I can't swear it was this show, but it was certainly a local radio call-in show.
Well, let's just say it was.
Let's say it was this. Let's claim that. And there were some local experts talking about a proposition to turn downtown St. Louis into farmland. And that just really stuck with me. You know, I'd done... Without ever really meaning to, for the years before that, I'd been doing this sort of inadvertent tour of the Rust Belt. I grew up in central New York, Syracuse area, so part of the Buffalo, Rochester Rust Belt. I went to school in southwest Ohio near Dayton, then up to St. Louis. And then the year I left St. Louis, I moved to Michigan and discovered Detroit. And so it's a lot of sort of things that I had been thinking about growing up, about the, you know, a diminishing, shrinking city, and going from one shrinking city to the next. And that just planted a seed, that the thing that I heard on the radio that day planted a seed. And the next year when I moved to Michigan, I heard the same thing again. I heard it was a local public radio call-in show there, different experts, but raising the same question. Maybe we should turn Detroit into farmland.
Well, it's actually a locale you could have chosen any number of cities because so many of them are in the same kind of position.
Yeah.
What was Detroit like when you first were exposed to it?
It was startling, you know, even though I was used at that point to, you know, urban decay and cities on the decline. What I saw there was just striking at a scale that I hadn't seen before. You know, I was used to growing up. My father grew up in Syracuse, and I was used to going on car rides with him. And he would point out to me, you know, places that used to be, you know, where GE used to assemble their televisions and where Carrier used to build, you know, things that used to be. And so, you know, I was used to that. I was used to sort of vacancy, and I think my mind sort of seeks to fill spaces that are now absent with just imagining what was there and what life had been. But going to Detroit, it was just, there was so much of that, so much emptiness, so much blight. And especially at the time, there were all so many of those ruins were intact. There were neighborhoods that were still standing, but almost nobody living in them. There were most of the manufacturing that had been active decades before, you know, the buildings were still there, even if the activity wasn't. It's changed a lot in the last decade or so. You know, a lot of that, they've been fighting blight to a great extent, and so a lot of that has been raised. And so now the landscape is different in that there's a lot more just emptiness. You know, you can sort of go into the middle of the city and see for acres of emptiness, and that didn't used to be the case. So it's shifted, but it's still very stark.
And it's such an iconic city. I mean, I've referred to it in promoting this program as having once been a muscular city because of what it was and what it represented in this country. As GM went, so did went the nation. As Detroit went, so went the nation.
And I think that's why it's become such campaign fodder recently. Yeah. You know, both of the candidates have been traveling to Detroit and talking about it as an example of, you know, the sort of fallen economies and communities that have completely been left behind. And it's precisely because it fell from so far.
Why did it fall? It wasn't all the auto industry. It was a combination of many things, wasn't it?
It was. And I think a lot of the things that happened there also happened in St. Louis. You know, a lot of it is, you know, industrial flight, but a lot of it is also really deeply related to race and discrimination and segregation. You know, and the roots for it go back decades. They go back much further than NAFTA. You know, they go back to the 50s when, deindustrialization started in the city, at least, and, you know, started moving out to suburban centers like they have here. And, you know, the workforces that were the most mobile followed them, which were the white workers and, you know, the African-American workers left behind. They had been cut out of, home ownership. They had very little, you know, value that they could take with them. And so, you know, you had a deeply segregated community. The riots happened, and that fueled even further white flight out of the city, which, you know, evaporated a tax base. So there were a lot of pieces to it. But, you know, one of the things that troubles me now is that we, you know, and again, getting back to our candidates, you know, I think they're talking a lot about the economic issues, and you know, the economic issues are certainly there, but I very rarely hear the race issues discussed.
Isn't that remarkable after the last couple of years, and you know, that we've had, starting with Ferguson and the number of police shootings that have happened since then, and of course most recently, that it really hasn't been talked about, didn't come up at all in the debate, for instance.
No, it's startling, and you know, I understand, you know, the importance of course bringing jobs back is finding ways to build economies too, but I'm not sure how easily that can happen if you haven't repaired a lot of the real foundational problems, the inequities, the inequalities, the access to education. You know, the education system in Detroit is in terrible shape. So much, you know, is underfunded, and just planting a few jobs there is not necessarily going to address the really deep-rooted problems.
Yeah, and you know, as I was reading your book, and as you've just suggested, I was thinking this could be about St. Louis. Aside from the riots that you just mentioned here, we didn't have that in St. Louis, but certainly every other element was there. I was just talking to someone in our newsroom who's come back from a trip overseas, and talking about how dismal our airports are compared to those visited overseas. You know, once again, something that's not been talked about that much in the campaign is the infrastructure needs we have in this country.
Right.
We're not talking about it enough, perhaps.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. There are a lot of communities that we're comfortable not talking about, and especially the ones who have the least access to infrastructure. And when I started the book, you know, because the seed had been planted when I was in St. Louis, it really started out more as a composite. It was partly St. Louis, and there are even some locations in there that still are St. Louis. It became over time, because I stayed in Michigan and learned a lot about Detroit. Over time, it became more about Detroit. But absolutely, I see a lot of overlaps between these two stories, and a lot of what I saw here, I carried with me. Because, you know, as much as Detroit itself is a fascinating place on its own, it was also, to some extent, you know, the phenomenon that was really interesting to me, that this is not an isolated case.
It took, correct me if I'm wrong, but it took about 16 years from start to finish in the book. That seems like a long time. why so long? Was it because the story was complicated, that the subject matter was complicated, or you just had other things to do? I know you've published other things in the interim.
Yeah, it's not an encouraging number, I think, for young writers to imagine that that's a normal path for a book to take. No, you're right. It was the complications. The complications of the subject matter, and also the complications of how I wanted to write the book, and in some ways I was grappling with large questions, and I wasn't even quite sure what the questions were at the time. You know, I had this idea, you know, wondering what it meant to live in a place like this that a lot of people, especially people on the outside, have considered to be beyond hope. But grappling with what that really means is difficult, and especially, you know, Detroit and St. Louis are very fragmented cities, and the problems are many and varied. And, you know, I found myself, as I started writing, you know, the book pivots around a lot of different characters and a lot of points of view. And that was reflective of how I discovered the story as I was going along. You know, I was interested in some characters. They would lead me to others. And gradually, over time, I came to see that the book was coming together around a sort of community of voices. And so in later years, as I was coming back to it, often what I was doing a lot of was finding new voices that I was missing, new parts of the story that I wanted to tell. But the book evolved really organically. And I like the results of that, but it is not an efficient way of writing a book.
How do you maintain control of your characters over that long a period of time? You've changed, conditions in Detroit changed, lots of things change, but you have to keep the characters, you know, fairly consistent and constant throughout the writing.
Yeah, and I think part of my process as a writer is that I allow them time, the characters time, to figure out who they are. And I think that's part of my struggle, is that, you know, because I was starting with place and, you know, sort of large questions, I wasn't necessarily starting with individual people. Now, the book absolutely came to be about individuals. You know, we're talking about a lot of
really large 11 stuff. Different profiles, I think you could say almost.
Right. And I think they're very closely observed stories of people. You know, it's the book lends itself to talk about, you know, sort of large scale social issues, but it's really a book about characters and individuals. And so, you know, I had a sense of who the characters were in a sort of vague way, but I think the 16 years was how long it took me to really get to know them and let them tell the stories that they needed to tell. And to some extent, you know, some of the chapters take slightly different forms as the voices of these characters emerge.
If you would give our audience a sense of the scope of your characters. Obviously, we can't talk about each one.
Sure.
But you have go from the very young to elderly, if you will. Just some sense of who your characters are.
There are a few different storylines through the book. One of the most dominant ones follows a cell of political activists who are doing what they can, staging protests and demonstrations. They've targeted one particular corporate entity in the city that they're very angry with for a lot of problems that they've caused in the city. So one of the focuses of the book is that their efforts to take down this corporation. But writing about that group got me interested also in the perspective of that corporation and some of the people working there. And so ultimately I found myself also writing from the perspective of one of the executives from that mm-hmm. company. There's a character who comes to Detroit from the outside and has never been there before. And he's the one who does a lot of exploring of the city. And he is up to no good.
That is Dobbs, who starts the book and is kind of a mysterious character throughout. Do you have a favorite character? Let me tell you mine. It was a little girl, Clementine. Was she 9 or 11 years old? Yeah. I've forgotten which. But, you know, she was just so symbolic of adjusting to the environment that was so bleak for her and for everybody around her.
Yeah, Clementine is one of my favorites too. And that one is an example of a character that I discovered late in the day. And what I realized was there was a perspective that I was missing. You know, I had Dobbs, you mentioned, as sort of an outsider. And so for him, he sees this sort of post-apocalyptic land of opportunity that he can take advantage of. And, you know, they're the activists who are, you know, sort of politically engaged in the scene. But there's Clementine and her great-grandmother, for whom the city is just a matter of fact. It's what they know. It's where they've lived. Mm-hmm. And they are making the best of it and leading the best lives that they can.
We'll talk more about the story and about other things related to the Angels of Detroit with Christopher Hebert, who is our guest in studio. By the way, Chris is going to be at Left Bank Books tonight at 7 o'clock. He'll be talking more about Angels of Detroit, and we'll do some signings as well. We'll come back and take time for more questions. And if you have anything you'd like to say to Chris, feel free to give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. If you'd like to send us an email, do so at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on Air. Back in a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Chris, you are quoted as saying in one of the interviews I read that you had done about this book that you want different readers and expect different readers to see different things. What do you want them to see?
I think I'm most interested in honoring the complexity of this world, of a city like Detroit and of the lives of people who are living on the margins of a place like that. It's been interesting to see responses and reviews to the book because they've often come on different opposite poles. You know, on one hand, there are a lot of reviewers who see it as a book about hope, which I like. There are others who see it as a book about the apocalypse and how, you know, Detroit is emblematic of a really troubling future that we don't really seem able to halt or control. And I can see both of that. You know, I think both of those aspects are represented in the book. And I think I'm interested in embracing that ambiguity because I do think these issues are complex. And if we're not able to think about that complexity and think about the different kind of lives that are being lived there, it's really hard for us to dress what these places really mean and what's to be done about them.
Was that a conscious attempt on your part to use it as kind of portending the apocalypse?
Well, I didn't want the book overall to be portending the apocalypse, but Dobbs, the character who arrives, you mentioned, I think he is somebody who is thinking, who's, I think, driven by those sorts of thoughts. And, you know, and those exist. You know, there are plenty of people who, you know, can look outside and, you know, in a city that is falling apart, in a world that's facing challenges that we don't know how to solve, and can feel frightened. And, you know, for him, that is part of the impetus that pushes him to take advantage of the city.
What did you want the reader to come away with regard to an impression of the corporate world?
That's a good question. It's complicated because I started out, you know, with an interest in these activists and, you know, the work that they were doing to raise awareness of some of the issues in the city. But then, I also came to really empathize with, you know, the woman that they were targeting. In part, though, it's less, I think, because of a general attitude toward business than I was toward her as a particular individual. And for me, she became someone who had ties back to Detroit from its glory days. And that was a piece of the book that I really, again, fairly late in the day, I realized that I wanted to develop, too. You know, a lot of the book is focused on Detroit now and what it looks like now, but I felt like there had to be a connection to what it was, and so she was my avenue toward thinking about how we really got to where we are. And she, as somebody who was growing up fairly privileged in Detroit in the 50s and coming to understand some of the responsibility she and her family and her friends have for the things that fell apart, for their lack of awareness about some of those complexities.
That character, Ruth Freeman, was also a very interesting character. And that chapter that you mentioned where she reflects upon Detroit as it once was, I've seen it written that was one of maybe your favorite chapter. It was one of mine, too. I thought it was very sensitively done.
It was one of mine, one of my favorites. You know, it's the one book, the one chapter, rather, in the book in which it's entirely historical, or almost entirely historical. And, you know, getting to inhabit that time and put yourself in a really nostalgic place. And, you know, I think it's really important to do that, even though so much of that is gone from Detroit. Those memories, for a lot of people, you know, that's what animates them. When people talk about the tragedy of Detroit, it's often that generation who remembers what they had. But I also don't want that to be a simple, you know, rosy nostalgia in which we overlook the fact that those were not rosy years for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, for a privileged class, it was a great place to live. But there was, you know, for African Americans and poor in the city, you know, there's a reason that the riots happened.
In my reading of the book, it changed my impression of her. I was looking at her not very sympathetically up to that point, and then suddenly that changed. I had a little more feeling and understanding for who and what she was.
And as a writer, I think I really enjoy doing that. And I think, you know, it's one of the things that writing and literature allows us that a lot of other art forms don't, which is the opportunity to really spend time with a character and find out who they really are and, you know, explore them with empathy. And that doesn't necessarily mean finding that, you know, everyone is at heart a wonderful person. I think at heart she's a complicated person. Sure. But
as we all are.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, just like I wanted to honor of the city, it's both the good and the ill. I think that's true of all the characters, too. I mean, the activists, too, are deeply flawed. They are not entirely noble or effective at what they're doing. And that's what, for me, what makes characters interesting, is when you can find both the good and the problematical.
Right. Let's take a call. We've got James in St. Louis who wants to get into the conversation, so let's bring him in. Go ahead, James. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go ahead.
Great. I'm an architect that works in North City with a number of nonprofits on sustainability issues, and wanted to just actually congratulate you, sir, on your it sounds like a very well-written and well-researched book coming from a place like Detroit, where one of my favorite heroines comes from Gracie Boggs, that you may have heard of.
Of course, yeah.
But what I wanted to say is congratulate you on the complexity of your thinking. the ability to try to synthesize these many disparate elements that are obviously involved with our present-day society. And congratulations on doing that and emphasizing that, because it seems like today, politically, so many of us just want very simple answers. And I think the simplest answer that we could possibly offer to that question is to understand character and effectively love our fellow man. So thank you for your work.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling, James. Nice to have you with us. I'm going to say something now that you might find unusual and might totally disagree with. I found Detroit as a character in the book to be just a very subtle character. I expected to be more of a presence in the book, but everything was very, very subtle. You didn't just bang away at certain, you know, vacant housing and all of the problems the city has. It was just there.
Yeah. That was one of the complicated issues for me, and especially it's reflective of the amount of time it took for this book to come together. You know, when I started this book in 1999, Detroit was in the extreme state that it's in, but it wasn't very well known beyond its own boundaries. You know, it wasn't until the bankruptcy and a lot of other things started happening that it became national news. So, you know, by the time the book was finished, the news had caught up with what I was doing. So I was imagining early on having to describe this place to a readership who had no idea that this existed, that any of this was happening. But one of the other things that happened is, you know, I think within the local community, Detroiters became very sensitive about a lot of the portrayals that they were seeing. And it started becoming sensationalized. You know, this industry of ruin porn grew, where, you know, people come from all around the world to take tours of fabulous empty buildings, which are sort of beautiful in a certain light. But also, you know, you can understand why for the community that sort of gawking at misfortune feels not very good. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things that I struggled with, was wanting to represent the city truly, you know, not pretending, not wallpapering over all of the ruins, but also trying not to dwell on them and exploit them in a sort of, you know, playing on your emotional heartstrings easily. But finding the balance was difficult, and I it would be nice if I managed to thread that needle.
Yeah, I think you did, and very effectively. I've known a number of people who are from Detroit who live here now or live elsewhere now. But one of the constants with those people is how much they love that city. Mm-hmm. They're drawn back to it still. One of them is Leonard Slatkin, who is now the conductor of the symphony there. And he, of course, comes from St. Louis to Detroit. He loves the place, and I'm a little surprised at that because of the image and the reputation the city has.
A lot of people do. And that's what, you know, one of the really interesting things that's happened in the last couple of weeks, especially as I've been doing book events and I was in Michigan earlier this week, and a lot of the reviews of the book there have suggested, well, the book is about the Detroit that almost was. Because, it, you know, in the last month or several months, and within the last year, there's been a lot of development in Detroit, especially in the downtown, you know, the business district. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of land speculation. There are a lot of office buildings going up. There are a lot of fancy restaurants and cocktail bars and hip boutiques and coffee shops and a lot of cool stuff. And it's, you know, there is a pocket of the town that starts, you know, starting to look like, you know, this renaissance, a Detroit renaissance is underway. And yet you don't have to go very far beyond that to see the problems that remain. But I think, you know, there's a hunger for the story to be changing on Detroit, because so many people love it. You know, so many people have been living with, you know, the doomsaying for so long that they are very eager for an opportunity to say, look, now everything is changing. And I'm not quite ready to go along with that. Some things are changing, but I'm still not quite sure how we're addressing the larger city.
That reminds me a little bit of Cleveland. People just put down Cleveland for years and years and years until it got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or Museum or whatever. Right. And then suddenly it was a city once again. We only have a minute or two left here. In the research that you've done and the traveling that you've done, have you come up with any ideas as to, you know, what can be done to get cities back on their feet? We've mentioned there are so many of them in this predicament.
Yeah, there are, and I don't. you know, I guess it's the great luxury of being a novelist is that we get to ask difficult questions and not answer them. It's a, we get to embrace the ambiguity and let other people worry about it. But, you know, I think, you know, my desire to really write this book about particular characters and particular lives was a way of trying to bring back into the conversation the communities of people who really who live there and are still making lives there. Because I feel like that is often not a part of that conversation about what to do. The what to do conversation often takes place at a very top-down sort of level. And you know, to get back to the, you know, that caller's point about understanding the complexity, you know, I don't think, you know, cities, these problems will be solved if we can't really think about all of the complexities. And it's not just about bringing in jobs, which is so far the only point at which the conversation is taking
right.
place.
Do you live in Detroit proper? You're in Tennessee now.
I am in Tennessee, yeah. No, I we left Michigan several years ago. I'm a English professor now at the University of Tennessee. Had to follow a job. So it's been interesting. So I finished the book when I was remote and a bit distant from the city.
All right. Well, good luck to you with the book. I know you're on the tour now, and that means you're going to be a busy guy for a while. And we look forward to hearing more from you and reading more from you. Christopher Hebert, thank you so much for being with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.